Here in southeastern Wisconsin. Right now, wind is from the southwest at 13, humidity 63%, 78 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
One of the most interesting things in my line of work, when you read as many books as I do and speak to as many authors as I do, is that there will be those occasions when a book crosses your path and it never dawns on you that one could write a fascinating book about the topic at hand. Some topics just immediately seem like the most interesting, fascinating, sort of limitless topic imaginable, and others just have sort of an earthbound quality, at least at a glance. And then you just think about it a moment and you realize that this topic and this book unlock a whole universe of discovery and of new insight. And that is the experience I had with this book at hand called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World. Trade is, of course, something that is so central to all of our lives, but one of those things we simply don't think about. And it is so vitally important to the state of the world, of our own national economy, of what it is we consume. And its history is incredibly rich and complicated, and yet also seems to focus upon abiding principles, which over the generations have not necessarily changed that much. And in particular, what seems to be a human being's intrinsic desire to trade and barter with others. And this rich, complex history is explored in amazing detail by William J. Bernstein. Perhaps you know his well-known book, The Birth of Plenty. He's also written a book called The Four Pillars of Investing. And again, this latest book is called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and I'm very excited about the next few minutes being able to speak with William J. Bernstein about his wonderful new book. William J. Bernstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Happy to be here, sir.
Your book is published, as I just said, by Atlantic Monthly Press. Was this excerpted in Atlantic Magazine?
Oh, I wish. No, sir.
It seems like the kind of thing that might have appeared in the pages of that magazine, but I didn't remember seeing it there. I'm glad it comes to us in the form of this book. Tell us what gave you the idea to create a book around this topic, and I wonder if it was at all a hard sell, given the fact that just at a glance it isn't the sexiest of topics.
Well, it's interesting because the sell was in my direction. I would have agreed with you when you started, when you said that it didn't seem like a terribly interesting topic at first. And it was, in fact, assigned to me. About 4 years ago, I got a phone call from an editor at Grove Atlantic, Inc., and they asked me if I was interested in writing a book about world trade. And my first response was, surely you've got the wrong Bernstein. You want Peter Bernstein. And they said, well, actually, we had lunch with him last week, and he's busy writing a book about the history of the Erie Canal, but he said there's this other Bernstein, and that's how I came to write this book. This book was actually assigned by me, and at first I have to admit I wasn't terribly enthusiastic about it, but that very quickly changed.
At what point did it change, and at what point did this book begin to take on the scope which it has? I mean, was it always going to be this sprawling history of trade around the world, or did it become that?
No, it was assigned to me that way. They wanted a wide-angle book about the long-range history of world trade, and it very quickly became a fascinating topic because what I was looking for were thematic anecdotes or stories that explained the process. And you don't have to come across very many of these stories before you realize that the stresses and the cracks and the strains and the discontents of globalization are a very old story, centuries old, and in some cases even millennia old. And all you have to do is change a couple of the proper nouns and modernize the grammar a bit, and you might as well be ripping the latest AP wire from a Senate Trade Committee hearing.
Right. Of course, certain specifics are different, too, in that we might not be talking about camels and frankincense, but otherwise many of the issues, many of the things that can be potential problems, and the way in which trade can mean a bonanza for certain people, a lot of those are sort of eternal truths still with us.
Yes, absolutely. You have that exactly right. And not only that, but, you know, you very quickly find out that the world didn't suddenly become flat when Al Gore invented the Internet. This is a very old process.
I want you to share with our listeners the simple little anecdote which begins the book's introduction. We almost get the sense that this was sort of an epiphany for you in a sense. Tell us what happened to you in a hotel lobby in Berlin, Germany.
Yes, it's September in 2004, and I'm just heading out for the morning for a day of sightseeing in Berlin, and the hotel clerk and I are exchanging greetings in our fractured English and German, respectively, and I take an apple out of the bowl on the hotel clerk's dais there, and I put it in my backpack, and by and by, I get hungry later on in the day, and I eat the apple. I'm sitting in the Tiergarten with my wife, and I almost didn't notice this little sort of label on the apple, the sort of little label you see on pieces of fruit, and it said product of New Zealand. All right, now here it's September. They're picking apples in Europe. And yet here I am, you know, eating this apple, which obviously was not a terribly expensive item. They were giving them away for free at this not horribly fancy hotel. And New Zealand, if you look at the globe, is almost exactly on the other side of the world from Germany. So here I am eating this bulk product, this fruit from the other side of the world. At exactly the same time, they're harvesting them from the trees in Europe. So that was sort of an amazing experience for me.
You say televisions from Taiwan, lettuce from Mexico, shirts from China, and tools from India are so ubiquitous that it is easy to forget how recent such miracles of commerce are. What better symbolizes the epic of global trade than my apple from the other side of the world, consumed at the exact moment that its ripe European cousins were being picked from their trees? In a sense, your book is not about that. Your book is also about how, although this seems like something unique to our own moment, that it's not as unique to the present day as we think. That, in fact, this has happened to varying extents throughout almost all of our history.
Yes, very early in human history, goods were being transported over very long distances. As long ago as 5,000 years ago, for example, the Mesopotamians were trading grain for copper from about 1,000 miles away, and they probably were obtaining luxuries from the Indus Valley, which was almost 3,000 miles away. By the dawn of the Common Era, the Romans had a fairly vigorous trade with China. You're talking about basically the ends of the known world trading with each other. Now, you know, admittedly, these were very low-volume trades. They were trades in low-volume, very high-expense goods, silks and porcelains and silver and jewels and things like that. But and the other truly amazing thing about the Roman trade with China was that neither country really knew of the other. The trade was carried through multiple intermediaries over great distances, and it probably took silk and silver as long as 3 or 4 years to get from one place to the other.
So we're talking about in the earliest day trade of what you call only the most prized merchandise traveling between continents. And now what happens today is we're doing that with something as mundane as an apple.
Yes, sir. That's exactly it. And, of course, that has to do with the fall of transportation costs.
And there have been, of course, moments in history when those costs have absolutely plummeted. I mean, just to jump ahead for a moment, when you're talking about how trade begins to look in the 19th and 20th centuries, you tell us between 1830 and 1910, the costs of shipping by sea, canal, or river fell somewhere between 65 and 87%. I mean, and that's just one moment in history where those costs come down. And, of course, as those costs come down, the possibilities become nearly limitless.
Yeah, and the thing that I found absolutely fascinating about that is that one dramatic moment in time, and it was a moment in time that wrought more changes, more dramatic changes than I think we've seen at any point, even in the 20th century. I mean, the internet, the jet plane, the personal computer, I think those things pale in consideration with what flowed from the invention of the blast steel process by Henry Bessemer. Steel before that time was a very expensive product. It wasn't of uniform enough or high enough quality that you could cast it into steel railroad rails or high-pressure boilers. The railroads and steam engines before that time were really quite primitive and couldn't take the kinds of loads you needed to handle bulk products. So this one man set in train a series of events that we're actually still living with today in terms of political economy. I mean, a lot of the views that we have today about protection and free trade flow directly from Bessemer's process.
It's so fascinating, too. You think about the way that this has utterly changed our lives and the way we live and the way the whole world functions. And it's this invention that most of us have never even heard of.
Yeah, precisely. Well, I think most people know what the blast steel process looks like. They've all seen pictures of this explosive process and sparks flying in school or on educational television. But yeah, it's something that's part of everyday life, and we tend not to think of it as a dramatic event, but it was one of the most dramatic events and one of the most important events, I think, in all of human history.
Sure, but none of us realize that, or very few of us realize its importance, and the vast majority of us can't even put a name to it. So.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, it's striking to me, and I wonder, as you said about writing this book, I think one of the things that surprised me and amazed me is that if one is going to write a book about something like trade, and if you're going to do so very comprehensively, a rich history from all over the world, you end up talking about a whole lot more than ships and products. You end up talking about things like war and plague and all other kinds of subjects that wouldn't immediately spring to mind as being part of this story.
Yeah, I mean, my model for that is a book that was written by Daniel Yergin about 20 years ago called The Prize, and it was a history of oil, the modern oil industry. But in effect, really what it was a history of the world during the 20th century looked at through the lens of oil. And I have to admit that sometimes consciously and sometimes subconsciously, that's what I strive for when I write a book, is when you write about a broad history like trade over a long period of time, what you really try to do is to write a history of the world from the point of view of trade.
Hmm. We're speaking with William J. Bernstein, and we're talking about his book called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World. This is a really interesting examination of this long history, beginning with its origins. And this is one of the things that is of such fascination, I think, to me and to most people, that we can actually peer into the dawn of human history and learn so much, despite the fact that, of course, so little of that world tangibly remains. Talk just for a moment about the challenge of trying to uncover the very earliest evidence of human beings trading with one another. To what evidence must we look to learn about ancient history in this way?
Yeah, the process that you're talking about, the phenomenon that you're talking about, is what I call history's flashlight. It's like you're in a huge, dark cave, and you've got a very small, very weak flashlight, and you can only hold it at a certain angle. So there are only some very small parts of the wall of the cave that you can see. Well, when you're talking about human prehistory 15,000 years ago, which is the period we're really talking about here, what can you see? What can you examine? Well, you're limited to things that are extremely durable. So the only evidence that you have are stone and later on metal tools, maybe bone tools. So you can illuminate that. And then you're also dealing in a lot of times with climates that are very dry. So you're more likely to find good evidence in a place like Egypt or Palestine or Iraq than, say, in Southeast Asia or Mesoamerica or Central or South America, where it's warm and humid and things corrode. So the very first trade that we really have evidence of is in obsidian. And obsidian is this sort of black volcanic rock. It's used by landscapers. It's actually a glass, and it's made only, as I've said, in volcanoes. And the one characteristic that it had that made it very valuable to prehistoric man was that it, although it was very fragile, it was also extremely sharp. While it lasted, it was a great cutting tool. And so you have this good that's only produced in a couple of places, yet it's extremely valuable. So it was transported for, in cases, up to 1,000 miles, not only in the Old World, but also in Central America and the Yucatan as well. There were some volcanoes where it was produced, and it was transported for thousands of miles. So this was obviously a trade item. What makes it fascinating to the modern investigator is that you can actually identify which volcano these things came from their atomic fingerprints. So you can actually trace the trade away from the volcano over hundreds of thousands of miles along trade routes. And a man by the name of Colin Renfrew is the man who's done most of this work. And it's fascinating work to read.
Of course, what's interesting and so tantalizing is that we can't really know, I suppose, very much about what was exchanged for it, or if in some cases, if this obsidian was just forcefully taken. but you are suggesting that obsidian was an item of trade in this very, very early period. Is there much we can know beyond the fact that somebody traded something for it?
You hit the nail on the head, sir. We do not know whether this was simply expropriated or whether it was traded. When you're going that far back, all that you can generally tell is that something moved in one direction, and you're generally not going to have any evidence what, if anything, was moved in the other direction.
I recently interviewed an author. I don't remember who it was or the book, but one of the points of this book was undertaking to try to understand the lives of ordinary people in Roman times. Actually, come to think of it, was not an author. It was a visiting professor, I think. But they talked about how so much of the evidence that remains from the ancient world is from the wealthy, because it was the wealthy who could afford to erect statues of themselves and build temples and so on. And ordinary people didn't have the means to do that. They built such things, perhaps, but none of those sorts of things belong to them. So the footprint of ordinary people in so many cases is lost to us in certain eras, or largely lost, and we have to look in kind of indirect ways to see the evidence of what their lives was like. But it's interesting, what you're pointing at here in still more ancient times is actually something left behind by what we would presume to be ordinary people.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Most of the archaeological finds that you deal with are, of course, burial mounds of very wealthy people, royalty. You know, one does find, however, in prehistoric societies, tools which were presumably made by ordinary people, and durable household items from poor people as well. But you're right; it's the archaeological record is very heavily canted in favor of the wealthy.
In talking about how apparently in some places we find tantalizing hints of things such as the trade of tin and other things, you say, if there was long-range trade in tin around this year of 3000 BC, There must also have existed a similar long-range barter for other valuable items, such as linen, frankincense, myrrh, tigers, ostrich feathers, and a thousand other sights, sounds, and smells now lost to history. You say that so beautifully. I mean, in a sense, that sums up what is so frustrating about this. Fascinating and frustrating that the little we learn makes us so hungry to know more. And to a large extent, it isn't possible to know everything we want to know about this period.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. The farther back you go, the less detail you have, and that was sort of one of the pleasures of the book is the book was written more or less chronologically, in a historical sense. So the further I got on with the process, the more of the ostrich feathers and the linens and the frankincense that I saw. In fact, I saw quite a lot of frankincense as early as the 3 or 4,000 B.C., so there was some satisfaction even early on.
Hmm. By the way, another topic that we wouldn't immediately think is going to be part of this, but of course it is. You can't do any of this without it in our own day, is the whole existence of currency, which you call at one point sort of a lubricant of commerce. Without it, trade required barter between pairs of commodities. Tell us, or explain just a little further, what changes about trade when there is currency at play versus simply barter?
Well, it's just one more thing that makes it more, it's a technological advance, just like transport, that makes it easier to trade. Imagine for a moment you have 10 different goods that you're exchanging, even locally, let alone over long distances. Well, if you don't have money, you have to barter them by pair. And there, if you do the math, there are 45 possible pairs of 10 goods. And of course, if you have 100 goods, the number grows basically exponentially. There's almost 5,000, I believe, if you take 100 different goods. So this is a very inefficient way of doing things. The price you have to have, if you're bartering or you're trading, say, barley, then you have to have a price for it in cows and in chickens and in cotton and in every other good that the other guy wants to trade you for them.
So I'll give you one cow for this much barley,
right,
or I'll give you one goat for this much silver or whatever.
Yeah, and maybe he doesn't have cows or goats. Maybe he's got one of 100 other goods, and you've got to know or have to be able to figure out what's the correct ratio of value between those two goods. But if you have, money and you have 100 goods, instead of having 5,000 or so pairs, you only have 100 prices. And the world becomes a much easier place. And one of the really, truly remarkable things is that coined money is a relatively recent invention. We really didn't have coined money before the Lydians invented it about 2,600 years ago in 600 B.C. And before that, silver was a medium of exchange. It was done by weight, but it's very, very inconvenient if you're going to use even silver as an intermediary to be dealing with these bars and weights of silver.
We're speaking with William J. Bernstein. We're talking about his book called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World. Also in this portion of your book dealing with kind of the earliest of examples of trade, you talk about a really extraordinary work of art which shows us something about maybe what early trade looked like to some extent. A mortuary sanctuary with a painted relief that apparently is very, very helpful. And you even give us a little sample of it in your book. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
Oh, this is a mortuary frieze at Deir el-Bari, which dates from about 3,500 years ago or so. And there was a queen, Queen Hatshepsut, who actually, since she was a female, and the pharaohs were supposed to be male, basically clothed herself and presented herself as a male. She commissioned a trading expedition, which went to the land of Punt, which was probably Somalia. So we're talking about voyaging perhaps 1,000 miles down the Red Sea. And the frieze depicts the various stages of this journey. They're actually, it's divided more or less into four panels. And the four panels show the various stages of this journey. And it's quite obvious what they were doing was trading. They were loading cloths and sacks of grain onto the ship, the things that Egypt produced in an enormous quantity. And they get to Punt, and then they offload these trade goods, and then they onload the things that they wanted from the land of Punt, which were incense plants and exotic animals. And so this was not an expedition of conquest. This was clearly an expedition of trade, and it showed in great detail.
I mean, and how wonderful that we have this to look at, because of course this comes in an era when that kind of really direct representation of what trade was probably is fairly scarce.
Yeah, and the other thing it tells you, which is very interesting, is what the primary commodity of long distance trade was. And it's interesting that every era, every age, has its glamorous trade commodity. So, you know, 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, it was incense. And, you know, the question is, why incense? Well, it was used because it burned very evenly and it smelled nice, and you give offerings to the gods because the smoke curled towards heaven. But more importantly, you know, in the pre-modern era, the world smelled to the high heavens. People didn't bathe. There weren't sewage systems. And so you needed something to cover up the smell. And that was what incense was used for. And then, you know, 1,000 years later, the great luxury commodity, at least in the West, was silk. And then 1,000 years after that, it was spices from the Indies that was the great trade commodity of the era. And you can trace the rise, in some cases, the rise and fall of empires through these very glamorous commodities. For example, when you go to the old Nabataean kingdom, and you go to southeast Jordan, you see these amazing ruins that made it into the Raider of the Lost Ark, for example. Well, this was a trading center for incense. It was a stop on the camel train from the camel trains from Arabia, and it's why these cities became so very wealthy. You go to Venice, and what do you see? Well, you see this incredible wealth, these grand palazzos. Where did they came from? Well, they came from the wealth generated by the spice trade, which is what the Venetians and the Genoese also controlled. And of course, what isn't known, or what most people don't know, is that what the Venetians had that they traded for these spices with the Egyptians were slaves from the Caucasus.
I want to turn back to incense for a moment, because this is a great moment in the book, and also I think is a great example of the kind of surprising things we learn about human history when we take a close, thorough look at something like trade. You were just touching on why incense, of all things, would be at least at one point in time such a precious, prized commodity. You write, although our imagination allows us to conceive the sights and sounds of ancient civilizations, their smells are well beyond modern comprehension. In cramped cities lacking effective sanitation, the nose discerned location as well as any map. The odor of feces from main sewer lines and slaughterhouses, the scent of urine surrounding government buildings, temples, and theaters, or the particularly offensive olfactory assaults of the tannery, the fishmonger, and the cemetery. Amid such stenches, and where regular bathing and clean water and regular change of clothes were reserved only for the wealthiest citizens, few substances were as prized as myrrh oil, easily applied as a body lotion and capable of hiding the rank smells of everyday life. I mean, in a sense, this helps us think about and even try to experience through our imagination some facet of daily life in the ancient world, which otherwise never even occurs to us.
Yeah, it wasn't for nothing that the Magi brought frankincense and myrrh. There was a reason.
I also want to talk about silk. This actually comes early in the book as you introduce it as, of course, one of the really shining examples of of how extraordinary trade was achieved at a time when technologically it was not very easy to do so. First, just explain for a moment to our listeners why silk was such a prized commodity, reserved at least for a while, for only the very, very wealthy.
Well, that's because the palette of materials for clothing back then was so very limited. The poor used animal skins, which were hot and sweaty. There was wool, which was scratchy and also quite warm, very difficult to dye as well. There was linen, which was much more expensive and was, you know, wrinkled very easily, again, didn't dye very well. Cotton was available, but it was actually more expensive than silk, and the reason why is it had to be imported from India or from Egypt, and in the pre-industrial age, it was extremely difficult to manage to manufacture. A pound of cotton actually took several times the man hours of even a pound of silk. So silk, in a way, was this one fabric that not only felt fabulous on the skin, but also dyed very easily, and it very rapidly became the favorite fabric of the Western world. The problem was that before the Emperor Justinian, the Chinese effectively had a lock on it. They had a monopoly on it. And so before the year roughly 600 AD, if you wanted silk, it had to be brought all the way from China.
And you pose this question, how did goods get from China to Rome? Very slowly and very perilously, one laborious stage at a time. Just help us understand, even in brief, just how laborious and difficult a journey we're talking about.
Well, there were two ways to get silk from China to the West. The route that everybody thinks of is, of course, the famous Silk Road. And the problem with the Silk Road is twofold. Number one is that land transport is inherently more expensive than sea transport. Think about, you know, transporting a ton of something on your back or on a cart by land versus putting it into a boat and setting sail. And in fact, in the ancient world, the cost of transport by sea was 10 times cheaper than by land, so it was very much more efficient. The second problem with land transport was that it was even a bigger hurdle was that it was much more dangerous. Think about all the dangers of transporting something across dozens of kingdoms. And in fact, the Silk Road was really only open. It was only feasible during two points in history. One was during around the Common Era, when the Han Chinese were ascendant in the east, and the Roman Empire was ascendant in the west. And there were only really two stable empires in between those two, so you could get things across the Silk Road. In fact, that's how silk did first get to Europe. But the other route that was actually much more efficient and carried almost all of the trade between China and the West was the Indian Ocean route. And this got a big boost with the harnessing of the monsoon winds, which enabled you to cross the Bay of Bengal and the Arabian Sea and also the South China Sea pretty much in one fell swoop. And even this was a very, very dangerous route. I mean, if a sailor, you know, could survive more than three or four monsoon seasons, he or she was doing very well. But, you know, the sea route was also very laborious because it had to be done in stages. It had to be done in at least three monsoon stages. And, you know, you could theoretically do it in a couple of years, but goods probably took an average of 3 or 4 years to get from one end of the old world to the other. Both of the routes were fabulously expensive. Both of them were fabulously dangerous, and it was merely a matter of degree that the sea route was better than the land route.
Hmm. And of course, one of the consequences of that long and incredibly difficult journey is also then what the cost of those goods ultimately was. You say silk was costly enough in China. In Rome, it was yet 100 times costlier, worth its weight in gold. I mean, it's really extraordinary to think about that, and it helps us understand why it was such an incredibly precious thing that only a tiny, tiny, privileged, wealthy minority of the population could even dream about having.
Yeah, we don't know how many times the goods changed hands, but it was probably on the order of at least a dozen times. And, of course, at each stage along the way, each change of merchants, the price increased. And, you know, it wasn't until the second or third century that Romans could even afford to make a garment that was actually made entirely of silk. The most common form of it was sarissim, which was a weave of silk and linen. And I, you know, tell the story of this one degenerate Roman Empire named Elagabalus, who was so fond of silk that he powdered his face and plucked all the hair off of his body to show it to show his silk wardrobe off better.
you tell us that the sort of the nitty gritty of trade in this period, we don't know a whole lot about some of those details of how these transactions were carried out, but that a wonderful set of clues is given to us by some very uncommon papers that were found in an old storage room in Cairo. Tell us what these Janitsa papers reveal to us.
Well, Orthodox Jewish belief, or just, you know, 1,000 years ago, standard Jewish belief, law dictated that you couldn't throw away any document that had the word of God in it. Well, almost anything written back then had the word of God in it. So these Jewish merchants who lived in Fatimid Europe in the 10th, 11th, 12th century would keep these trade records. And these families were long-distance merchants, and they were spread between Gibraltar in the west all the way probably to India and certainly to Arabia in the east. And so their communications got put into this storehouse. It was called a Janiza, and it was a building that was used specifically for discarded documents containing the word of God. And what's interesting about them is that although they were written in Hebrew script, they were actually in the Arabic language, because that's what they spoke. And so this being Egypt, a nice dry climate, again, history's flashlight, this particular group of documents was preserved. And it became the life's work of a man by the name of Esti Gotin, who was a scholar, a Jewish scholar who worked in the United States. And he got a hold of these documents, and it was just, well, it was not only a record of family life, Jewish family life in that period, but it was also a marvelous record of the trade of the period. And it documented what goods were being transported, the customs of trade, how much it cost to ship goods from one place to another, the dangers and the risks involved, and the techniques. It was just a wonderful window into how trade was conducted during the 10th and 11th and 12th centuries.
You tell us it provides a rare glimpse into the slow, perilous, grim, gritty world of the peddlers who bought and sold merchandise.
Yeah, and that's the thing to realize about trade in the ancient world, is that it was in general the work of small merchants, and that was a process that changed very dramatically right around the year 1600 with the chartering of the English and Dutch East India Companies, because this is one of the central points of the book, is that trade is a very capital-intensive process. If you're going to set out on ships to the Indies to get spices, you've got to buy the ships. Those are expensive. You've got to hire large crews. They're expensive. You've got to outfit the ships with supplies, and particularly silver, to trade for the goods that you want. That's expensive. So you have to be able to raise huge amounts of capital. And that was something that these large organizations did very, very well, particularly right off the bat, the Dutch East India Company. And it wasn't very long before they took over the trade from these small peddlers.
Well, and I guess that points the way to something said a little later in the book. Stable countries are trading countries.
Yeah. Once again, that certainly comes into play along the Silk Road. And it also, you also see it, for example, very, very, very far back, into the Roman era, and you can actually trace the trade between India and Rome, and there was quite a bit of trade between India and Rome, by the gold coins that you find, the silver coins that you find on the Indian subcontinent. They, from time to time, people uncover in India these caches of ancient Roman coins, and you can date them very easily by the head of the emperor that's on them. And so you can actually trace the pattern in the flow of trade. And what you find is that the trade was very vigorous until the end of the reign of Marcus Aurelius, and then the coins virtually disappear after that date, after about, I believe it's 180 A.D. And then, of course, that's when Rome started to fall apart.
And, of course, I suppose it's busy just trying to survive and doesn't have the wherewithal to keep this connection with far-flung places.
Yeah, Rome, I mean, this is sort of, it's almost a cliche, but it's true, which is that Rome was essentially a plunder machine. Its economic strength was in very large part due to war booty. And, you know, when they ran out of places to conquer in the late 2nd and early 3rd century A.D., their economy fell apart.
Hmm. We learn about so many other important figures and elements in the history of how trade developed over the years. We just have time to touch on a couple of them, and of course we'll leave the listeners to seek out your book and read about all of this in much greater detail. I was surprised to find the name of Christopher Columbus in your book as being a truly pivotal figure, not so much for that famous first voyage to the New World as for his second voyage.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to stay away from well-known stories, but I couldn't stay away from Christopher Columbus. First, there are three things about that. The very first thing is that Christopher Columbus wasn't looking for the New World. He wasn't even looking for souls to save. He was looking for spices. Spices were the primary trade commodity of the era. The Portuguese essentially controlled the eastward route around the Cape of Good Hope. They had just discovered that route. And so he was looking for a way of getting to the Indies to get spices by sailing west. And, you know, at that time, no civilized, educated person thought that the world was flat. Everybody knew that it was round who had an education. And what Christopher Columbus did is he made sort of the spectacular error of wishing, thinking that the world was much smaller than it was, so he could actually survive the journey to the Indies, when in fact everybody knew, and Columbus didn't realize, that the world was much bigger than it actually was, and it wasn't, you know, it was only by happy accident did he run into this continent, the New World, you know, North and South America, before he starved to death. So he was both wrong, and he was very, very lucky. And it wasn't until his third voyage that he realized that he hadn't gotten to Asia. The most important voyage of Columbus, as you pointed out, was his second voyage, the one in 1493. It was a much larger voyage than his first. He had 17 vessels instead of three. And the vessels contained almost the entire Western inventory of domesticated plants and crops and animals. And so this seeded the North American continent basically with cattle and pigs. And, of course, he brought back potatoes and tomatoes and chili and, most importantly, corn. Because there were vast swaths of the old world, which really were very poor agriculturally. They were too far north to produce rice, or they were too far south to produce wheat. And this in-between corn fit this in-between area of southern Europe, this vast impoverished area of southern Europe and the Ukraine very nicely, and allowed these areas in the subsequent centuries to prosper. Pretty much the same thing also happened further north in poorer soils with the importation from the New World of the potato. So what you had was what has been termed the Columbian Exchange, in which at its crudest level, animals, livestock from the Old World populated the New World, were introduced into the New World, or in the case of the horse, reintroduced, and these plant crops from the New World seeded the Old World.
Hmm.
And that's just the major ones. I mean, they're, you know, minor ones like the pineapple, the avocado, you know, the fruit and nut trees of Europe were also of massive importance, but they weren't as important as the cow, the pig, and corn and the potato.
Hmm. Your book goes on, of course, to explore all kinds of other facets of this rich and fascinating history, including the very significant role played by the Muslims and the incredible dominance which they exerted over much of this, the way in which the balance of trade changes, the way in which modern trade has changed in a lot of different ways, and various technologies that have made certain breakthroughs possible. I want to touch on a couple of really central points to finish. You have already touched on the fact that we seem to have, as human beings, have this very strong impulse, almost as much as breathing, an impulse, a desire to trade with others. Your book talks about that, but secondly, about the fact that this urge to trade has had a gigantic effect on how human affairs have played out, that our hunger for trade and our hunger for goods has also then, in a sense, created many wars and created many friendships and all kinds of artistic breakthroughs. I mean, we would not be the same race we are today were it not for this part of our makeup.
Yeah. You know, certainly trade has been a vehicle for the, if you will, the intellectual insemination of all of mankind. It's the most spectacular example occurs, you know, with the Battle of Talas, which was a battle between the Chinese and the one of the early Muslim empires of South Asia. And what happens at this battle is that, first of all, the Muslim empires wanted to attack China because they wanted to control its trade. And at this Battle of Talas in Central Asia in the late 8th century A.D., some Chinese traders and soldiers are captured who know how to make paper. And the West, of course, hasn't been the same since. I mean, you know, what did you write things on in Western Europe before 770 A.D.? Well, you used parchment, and if you were in Egypt, you use papyrus, both of which are very, very difficult to manufacture and aren't terribly efficient, or you could write in stone. And all of a sudden, you have this medium that allows you to communicate much more easily. So it's a momentous episode in the intellectual history of mankind. The you know, it's not only a positive, it can be a negative as well. The Bessemer story moves forward with an inundation of Western Europe in the late 19th century with all this cheap American wheat. And, of course, continental farmers react to that very, very negatively because this cheap foreign competition is undercutting them and basically destroys their market because they can't compete with this American grain. And so you get a global trade war between Europe and the United States, and you have a period of escalating tariffs that finally culminates in Smoot-Hawley in 1930, which most historians who've looked at it believe gave rise to great extent to World War II. I mean, had the Germans been able to sell us things, been able to export and sell us things, which Smoot-Hawley prevented them from doing, they probably would have recovered much more rapidly from Versailles and from World War I, and Hitler probably would have never come to power. The people in our State Department were very cognizant of that during the war, and as soon as the war was over, they set up the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And so here we are today.
Hmm. It's an amazing history. It's a history of incredible wealth and a history of plague, a history of wars, a history of friendship. It is our history told in this remarkable book called A Splendid Exchange, How Trade Shaped the World, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. William J. Bernstein, the author. William J. Bernstein, you have accomplished something truly extraordinary in this book, and I am grateful to you for writing it and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Well, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
Tomorrow on the morning show, it is the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And with him will be Morna Foy, who is the president of the Wisconsin State Technical